You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
I'm Anthony Painter. I'm Director of Institutional Reform here at the RSA. I'm delighted to welcome you here today. It's my great pleasure to introduce this afternoon's speaker, Adam Lent. Adam is Director of the Action and Research Centre here at the RSA, and he's my boss, but that won't change the way that I ask any questions. Adam leads our research and innovation into a wide range of areas, including major projects on the rise of microbusiness, social innovation, young entrepreneurs, creativity and new technologies, digital fabrication and closed-loop manufacturing. He writes a very widely read blog on enterprise and creativity, and contributes to a whole suite of other publications. His forthcoming book is currently being crowdfunded by Unbound Publishing. I had a look just before this session started. It's on about 50% or so. So we'll monitor that at the end of your talk, and we'll see how it's gone down and see how close you are to the 100%. So let's get started. Over to Adam.
Thank you very much. I'm going to start by talking about this, Bitcoin, which I'm sure nearly all of you have probably heard of, although, of course, many people don't really know what it is. But very simply, it's a form of digital cash. So like cash in the real world, it's anonymous when you use it. No one knows where it's going, who's using it and who's spending it and who's getting it. And it's simple to use, like cash. And, of course, when most people go online now, they tend to use a credit card or a debit card or PayPal. Bitcoin, or its aspiration anyway, is to be just like cash, anonymous, simple. Now, that's pretty interesting in many ways. But really, I think the much more interesting thing about Bitcoin is really how it works rather than what it actually is. And how it works is that it is one of these, a decentralized, autonomous organization. Now, a bit like the internet back in the sort of mid-90s, no one really exactly knew what its potential was, and a lot of people didn't really know what it was at all. No one really knows what decentralized, autonomous organizations are going to be in the future, but you probably ought to get used to seeing these initials, this acronym, because like the internet, you'll probably be hearing a lot more about it. Now, Bitcoin is the first working example of one of these. And the geeks in Silicon Valley and elsewhere are very excited by it. And there is already venture capital going in to developing this type of organization. What the technology behind Bitcoin has done has allowed people to interact with each other over the internet without any need for any sort of third-party monitoring or third-party coordination or regulation. So the trust that can exist between two people using Bitcoin is built into the very technology and the coding behind Bitcoin. So this opens up all sorts of mind-boggling possibilities, for example, and this is why it's exciting people so much in geekdom. It's possible, for example, that people online might set up a company together without any need for any regulatory authority to oversee the relationship between the people involved in that trading company. It might be possible, for example, for all of us to set up an online campaign or an online political party without the need for any leadership or central authority to make that actually work. So as I said, this is beginning to develop and it's beginning to get money behind it. Now, of course, Bitcoin has done that in the world of money and currency. The real cash we use in the real world is very heavily controlled and regulated, in theory anyway, by central banks. There is a big third party there keeping an eye on what's going on. This is the US Federal Reserve. It was founded in 1913. So this is the most important central bank in the world, in theory controlling the most important currency in the world, the dollar. It was founded in 1913, about in theory to bring stability to the US economy. 16 years later, there was the biggest financial crash that ever been in history, but we'll sort of skirt over that fact. But in many ways, this is emblematic of what I think the 20th century was about. The US Fed is big, it's centralized, it's hierarchical. It's the way that we thought, in this case, currency and money had to be controlled and regulated and run 100 years ago. This is the 20th century. I think that Bitcoin, decentralized, non-hierarchical, autonomous, much smaller, is the 21st century. So the big trends that I think we're beginning to see 14 years into this century is a move away from a world shaped by a handful, a few big hierarchical centralized organizations to a world shaped by many small, flat, decentralized structures. And if we look at many of the institutions that secured their power in the 20th century, I think we can see their power gradually being chipped away by smaller organizations and smaller decentralized structures. So let's take our political parties, for example. The mass hierarchical centralized party began to be developed in the 19th century, but really secured its position of power and centrality to our political system during the 20th century. As many people know, these parties don't have the same support and membership they once had, but not many are aware of quite how precipitous the drop has been. So this graph shows the membership of the three main parties, Conservative, Labour, Liberal Democrat, from the war up until the present day. Back in the 1950s, these three parties had about 3 million members between them. Today, they have about 300,000. So over those 70 years, their membership has fallen down to a tenth of what it once was. But their allegiance amongst voters has also fallen. So again, back in elections in the 1950s, the two main parties, Conservative and Labour, were securing about 95% of the vote. At the last election in 2010, they secured about 65%. And it's pretty strong likelihood that next year, in 2015, at the next election, they may secure even less than that. But I think what's particularly interesting about this is the last time a big political party in Britain died, it was the Liberal Party in the first half of the 20th century. What was it replaced by? It was replaced by another big centralised hierarchical party, the Labour Party. What we're seeing today is something very different. Parties are declining as a whole, and they're not being replaced by another big party. They're being replaced by a bunch of small parties, UKIP, SNP, the Greens. But they're also being replaced by a whole variety of other forms of political expression, like online petitions, small campaigns, political stunts, a wide variety of different ways of trying to bring about change than the traditional 20th century route of a big party. Corporations, another vitally important institution in the 20th century, again, like the political party, gradually grew in power and influence in the 19th century, actually often in the face of very severe opposition, particularly in the United States, but then really took off in the 20th century and became an absolutely central feature of the way our economy is run. So that by the 1940s and 1950s, that big, centralized, hierarchical, highly bureaucratic, very powerful corporation was right at the heart of the American economy, and something that European economies in the wake of the war started to adopt for themselves. Now, I'm not saying corporations aren't still powerful. They obviously are still very powerful. But their power today is nothing like what it was back in the middle of the 20th century. For example, if you look at the top 100, the biggest 100 companies in the United States today, a third of those didn't even exist 10 to 15 years ago. There's a huge churn in the corporations that hang around, the incumbency rate of corporations that hang around at the top. And this is creating enormous volatility. So one study found that the CEOs of America's publicly listed companies, 80% of them had been ousted from their position before they were expected to go. This is like sort of football managers, corporations. There's so much volatility and stress in the world of corporations that CEOs themselves can't hang on to their jobs for very long. Now, some people say about this, well, isn't it the case that the old corporations that once existed are now just being replaced by new, big, centralised corporations like Google and Facebook, the new IT companies? And there's a certain truth in that, but I'd say two things about that. Firstly, whatever you think of Google and Facebook and those sorts of IT corporations, they're very different to what existed before. They've flourished because they have become successful platforms for the activity of millions of other smaller organisations and individual actions. They're not like the mass production companies of the middle of the 20th century, which literally churned out products to a passive bunch of consumers. Google, Facebook, etc. are flourishing because they provide a platform for other people to be active and take action. I would also say a second thing about that. If something like decentralized autonomous organizations and the technology behind that takes off, then there's really no guarantee that some of the big, the huge IT companies we have now are going to be around in 10, 20 years' time. It's quite possible that this new technology could well replace the social networks, the search engines that we now rely on, and those themselves become far more decentralized and actually controlled by the individuals who use them, rather than a chief executive and a board and a bureaucracy at the very top. It's very reminiscent of the thought of an economist called Joseph Schumpeter, who some of you may have heard of, who is famous for arguing that it's in the nature of capitalism to be creatively destructive, that you get big companies controlling the economy, but those are always subject to challenge from smaller, innovative, more fleet-of-foot companies from below, which then themselves kick those companies out, themselves become big and slow and uninnovative, and they themselves get challenged from below. What's often known about Josef Schumpeter is that towards the end of his life, he died in the middle of the 20th century, he began to change his mind. He actually looked at the corporations that were in control of the economy and thought, actually, I was wrong. That creative destruction that happens in capitalism isn't happening anymore. The big companies are now too big and powerful. They've got too much control. So that innovation now has to come from the big companies, not the smaller challengers from below. Actually, he was probably right. But maybe what's happening now is we're going back to Schumpeter's earlier vision of much more churn and much more creative destruction happening. And then there's that biggest centralised hierarchical organisation of all, the state and government. I think we all know that governments don't have the same control over information flow that they once did. The internet, of course, has made it almost impossible, certainly for democratic governments, to control what people find out about, what they hear about the governments themselves. Even undemocratic governments, such as in China, even North Korea, is finding it almost fighting a daily battle to stop information flowing to their citizens and to control that. But What else do states do? Well, they're supposed to try and control our borders, exit and entry, keep an eye on their citizenry. Even that's being chipped away now. Back in 1990, there were 150 million migrants in the world. Now, there are 230 million migrants in the world. People are literally breaking themselves away from the state control and the countries into which they were born and moving to other places and chipping away at that particular power. It also indicates why so much of the debate that's going on at the moment around immigration is so irrational, because with that sort of flow of and that numbers flowing around the world, maintaining tight control over your borders is almost impossible. Another area of the state, of course, is around security and defence and military activity. There again, the state is beginning to lose out to smaller players. There was a great study which looked at 197 military conflicts that have occurred over the last 200 years between states, governments, and between non-state military, smaller military forces, guerrilla forces, etc. And that found that in the 19th century, the states won about 74% of those sorts of battles. In the first half of the 20th century, the state was winning 65% of those battles against non-state military forces. By the second half of the 20th century, they were only managing to win 45% of those sorts of battles. So again, even in the most fundamental aspects of a state's raison d'etre, defence and security, it's beginning to lose out to smaller, non-state, decentralised organisations. So that's the state, it's parties, the economy. It's before we even get into what's happened to society over the last 40 or 50 years. This is the Hog Farm hippie commune on their way to the Woodstock Festival in 1969. We all know that the sorts of constraints and social conformity which used to be imposed by the state, but also by the church and by various civil society institutions, has been worn away consistently over the last 40 or 50 years. So I suppose the really interesting question is, why is this happening? Now, if you listen to the egos in California, and you can buy a book about this every week that comes out, you'll be told that it's technology. It's the internet that's allowing this to happen. It's giving people the tools, the networks, the skills to be able to do things for themselves and challenge the big hierarchies and centralised organisations. But I think that's to confuse the symptom with the cause. I think the reason this is happening is for a much more fundamental human reason. It's this. It's about freedom, the desire for individual freedom. People, I think, almost naturally, inherently, want to break away from constraints that stop them making choices for themselves, making choices about their economic activity, their political activity, their social life, their lifestyles. And of course, the big, centralised, big organisation, the hierarchical organisation, tries to constrain that. It wants people to fit into a certain box, to take on a certain label. It doesn't naturally fit with individual choice and freedom. But this isn't new. This isn't something that's been happening over the last 10, 15 years since the internet really got going. This has been a wave that has been developing really, I would say, for the last 500 years. In fact, I think you can probably identify the date when this wave began. It was the 31st of October, 1517, because that was the day that this guy, Martin Luther, took on the first and for many years the only really big centralised hierarchical organisation, the Catholic Church. That was the day he sent a letter to his bishop complaining about the way the Catholic Church was behaving. And he probably didn't mean to set in train a certain course of events, but he did, because obviously that led to the Reformation. And something fundamental happened then, because what the message that went out was that you could actually make a choice for yourself about what your religion was. You could break away from a church that had ruled for millennia. You wouldn't go to hell. You had free choice in the issue. And really, once that genie was out of the bottle, it was impossible, and it's proved impossible, to put it back in. The desire for individual freedom, not just over religious life, but over every area of life, has continued to grow. Now, of course, there's been an ebb and flow. It's not been straightforward. In the 17th and 18th centuries, we had the rise of absolutism. Big hierarchy tried to reassert itself through the monarchy and through the church. That then was overthrown by the rise of liberalism in the 19th century, which once again put emphasis back on individual freedom, smaller organisations, limiting the control of big structures. And then, as I've been showing hopefully today, the 20th century came along and we once again became fascinated by the power of big hierarchy and centralisation and what that could do for us. But now, going into the 21st century, there's a counter-reaction to that. And I think individual freedom, smallness, decentralisation is back on the agenda. So what does it mean in the longer term? Well, I think it means more freedom and creativity. Breaking away from those big hierarchies allows individuals to flourish, allows smaller organisations to flourish and innovate and do things in different ways, which I think is enormously to be welcomed. But it also means more complexity and disorder. I'm afraid if you're one of those people, either on the left or the right, who sort of harks back to a world of certainty and stability in the 1940s and 1950s, you're going to be really disappointed and annoyed by the 21st century. It's not ever going to be like that again, certainly not in the near future anyway. It also means growing stress for those big centralised hierarchical bodies and the laws, regulations, cultures that support them. Because that 20th century ethic, the structures, the laws, they still exist. You can't see that anywhere better than in the political system, where in America and the UK, first past the post system, which of course has maintained the power of two big centralised parties way beyond any public appetite for them, is still in place. And we can see now how it's so massively under stress and strain that sooner or later it almost certainly will collapse. So finally, and I know this is a terrible old cliche, but I think the 21st century is going to be a roller coaster. It's going to be quite scary and uncertain as those big stable structures begin to break up. There's going to be a few people at the back looking around for a break and hoping there's a break on it and obviously not finding one. But there's also that sense of exhilaration and freedom and liberation that can come from breaking away from the big structures that once controlled so much of our life. And that's why I think small is powerful. Thanks.
Adam, thank you. Okay. I just want to sort of start off by sort of probing the core thesis, if you like. Because I wonder whether big is quite in as much retreat as you may think it is. I mean, you look to the rise of China, big, authoritarian, all the things which supposedly are under challenge, but it seems to be getting ever more powerful economically and politically, militarily. Potentially as well. The rediscovery of the economics of Keynes, which is about, you know, macroeconomic management by the state. The rediscovery of industrial policy as a statecraft. The Eurozone and its coming together and the control it has over nations and economies in their global agreements around climate change. That there's quite a lot of big that's growing as well. And how do you account for that, and what's the trajectory of that, do you think?
Well, I think there's I mean, there's a couple of reasons. I think we've obviously been through a period of very severe economic crisis over the last few years. And in that period, at a time like that, people inevitably look back to what existed in the past and what solutions were found in the past. And I think that explains why there is an upsurge of interest in Keynesian economics and economic management and industrial policy. But my own view is that it's, you know, it's understandable why people look back to that, but it's completely inappropriate for the world we live in now. I think the sorts of trends that I identified there mean the capacity of governments or central banks to actually control and regulate the economy and society more widely are, you know, they're dissipating. That world is not going to return. And I think certainly, you know, central banks, of course, as I suggested, have been around for decades. And we were told for many decades that central banks, through control of interest rates, could guarantee economic stability. Well, we saw what happened in 2008. So, you know, I think we need to learn the lessons of that. I think it's also, in terms of things like China, for example, it's also important to keep in mind that the 20th century and its focus on centralized hierarchies was, you know, an incredibly powerful and very recent period in our history. It actually took about a century to build up the conditions for the 20th century to exist. There was a long period during the 19th century where corporations gradually created the right legal structures for themselves, where governments gradually built the acceptance amongst the public for higher tax rates and bigger governments and welfare states, etc. So, you know, 14 years into the 21st century, it's not as though big is going to disappear overnight. And I don't think big will ever disappear entirely, but it will have to change. China, absolutely throwing its weight around, growing in economic power. Do I think China has a sustainable model for the long term in terms of its political and social and economic structures? Not at all. Sooner or later, I think there inevitably will be some sort of crisis, because those sort of structures just don't apply in the modern world.
Okay. I want to go back to this question of the state and tax. And, you know, the thing that links Martin Luther with Bitcoin is a sort of process of disintermediation, taking out the middleman. And one of the primary purposes of currency, of course, is so we can be taxed. And I wonder whether it concerns you, the growth of alternative decentralized currencies as a way of sort of developing what will in effect be a shadow economy. And so the things that we collectively provide will become gradually undermined. Is that just an inevitable process, or is it something we should be concerned about and respond to?
Well, I'm slightly, you know, sort of bemused by that sort of view that somehow we're creating a shadow economy. We have a shadow economy. It's largely funded by real cash. You know, people are involved in it when they hand over money to a painter and decorator who doesn't, you know, declare the VAT. Cash is used in all sorts of criminal activities. I don't see why we shouldn't have cash online just because it's going to give rise to similar sorts of activities. And anyway, in fact, these things aren't stoppable anyway. I mean, there's constant work to improve at the moment on Bitcoin and to develop new sorts of currencies and cash that can be used online. I think the big challenge is about taxation, is about the big state. And this really is the big challenge for the 21st century. Because the state did something very good in the 21st century. It prevented very high levels of inequality. It used a certain model of tax and then spend through public services and the welfare state to ensure that inequality didn't run rampant. By looking back to that model, as many people are doing these days, they're not confronting the real challenges we face in the 21st century, which is how do we confront and deal with inequality under a set of conditions where that big state model no longer is really sustainable. I don't have any obvious answers to that. I have some thoughts on it, but I certainly think we need to get real and understand how do we create and maintain equality in a world of small, decentralised, flatter organisations quite rapidly, really.
And you know, the margins obviously ultimately influence the mainstream. And this is a prime example where you have probably a mindset as much as anything else that is about freedom and creativity. And it's a very positive force, very, very innovative force. But then you still have a culture of expectation that there is going to be some safety net, some welfare, some support, that there are stable structures and so on. Are you worried about the sort of cultural phenomenon as much as the sort of social justice phenomenon that will knock on from the growth of small?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, clearly, and you can see this in surveys, people are becoming more individualistic. They expect to have freedom in a very wide range of areas of their lives. And I don't think this is anything to be shocked or upset about. This is, you know, as I explained there, this is a long wave thing that has been going on for many centuries. But it does create disorder. It does create much greater complexity. And under those circumstances, it is quite possible for certain individuals or organisations to gain quite a lot, even though they're quite small, gain quite a lot of control, maybe for quite short periods of time, and secure power and wealth for themselves. So I think we need to think about how the state, which I don't think the state's going to disappear, I don't think it should disappear, but the state needs to be a lot smarter about how it sets the conditions, the right legal frameworks, the right rules, to ensure that people are protected and ensure that people don't take advantage of the complexity and disorder, rather than thinking the state comes in and creates a whole model of support, a sort of superstructure over the rest of the economy and society.
Which brings us back to your point about political parties. And all these institutions that are facing decay, they do have a function and a purpose. And the purpose of political parties was to bring some coherence to a wide range of interests and perspectives. Now, certainly in theory, anyway. And you know, the concern has to be that we'll face either a very sort of volatile politics, very unpredictable and scary at times, or alternatively, a political quagmire. And if you look at what's happening at the federal level in America, you may even see the beginnings of this, where political action becomes very difficult and collective action becomes inhibited by the fact there is such a great degree of fragmentation. What sort of political world will we be in there?
Well, we didn't really have political parties for the first 150 years of modern parliament. We had a very different way of operating. We had loose associations of MPs and politicians, and they found ways of putting together, we had very effective governments. We had some rubbish governments. We had some very good governments. An empire was built.
We had a lot of corruption in Russell Burroughs
as well. Of course, yeah, absolutely. But that's as much cultural and the nature of the electoral system in those days. You know, I believe that we need to break beyond, because of these trends, break beyond the idea that somehow politics now needs to be controlled by some central elite based around a party leader. I don't think that fits with our times. I think there's a huge appetite out there now for more direct democratic type methods. I think one of the reasons we're seeing organisations like UKIP rise is because people want more control over what their MPs do. They want a say over what their MPs do. They want to hold their MPs to account. Now, that will undermine, undoubtedly, the control of the party whips, but it will also undermine the control of the media and the big party donors as well. And to me, that's about a step forward for democracy as much as anything.
Okay. Let's open it out now. In Schumpeterian terms, we've done economy, society, democracy. So let's take a range of questions. We've got the first one here.
Thank you for your talk. I have to echo Anthony's initial question in questioning the assumptions, because as someone who is leading an initiative to create a small, distributed, independent alternative to what exists today on the internet, at least, the world you describe is one that I don't recognize. On the internet today, what I see is a handful of monopolies, especially on the web, the Googles and the Facebooks that you described, their actual business model isn't necessarily to empower people to do things on their platforms. The reason they're so successful is because they sell people, not products. They sell people to people instead of the old school method of selling products to people, which was that what you described earlier. And I think if we're seeing anything, we are seeing a transfer of power from states, as you said, but that power is not going necessarily to a decentralized system of individuals. It's going to corporations. Call this multi-stakeholderism, as we were doing a few months ago at the Internet Governance Forum in Istanbul, which basically meant, well, large corporations should have a voice as well. So I guess my question to you is, are we really seeing a decentralized world here, or are we just seeing a transfer of power from one group of large organizations, in this case states, to corporations?
Okay, thank you. Next question.
Do you think human beings as individuals are responsible enough to be making wise decisions? Look at the democratic system, for instance. It's very short-termist. So something, I might vote for something because it might be good for me for in the short term, but in the long run, I could be making decisions that have a negative impact on society and my fellow human man.
Okay, thank you very much. And the gentleman just behind.
Thank you for your talk. Looking at sort of a very broad historical way, one could argue that institutions actually arose when people with power and wealth decided that aggregating people and production would suit them. In the same way, now one could perhaps slightly cynically say that in a sort of tacit way, they're looking to benefit both capital and power, looking to benefit from that disaggregation. I would argue that they would always want some high-level institutions such as the rule of law and, say, supranational organisations to maintain a globalised system. And so what you'll see is a hollowing out, in a way. You'll always get that top layer of institutions. But this is to actually suit power and wealth rather than individuals.
Great. Thank you. Really good questions there. So transfer of power from state to corporations, can we trust ourselves and will we see a sort of hollowing out of political authority effectively?
I think the role of the big internet corporations is quite complex, and I think we have to keep in mind what has occurred in the last 10 to 15 years because of the rise of these new platforms. They have been incredibly challenging to existing incumbent corporations, and they have allowed, I think, a flourishing of creativity and smaller initiatives in a way that we couldn't have imagined 10 years ago. So YouTube is a classic example where people generating their own videos, music, etc. online can now be distributed widely in a way that's been enormously challenging to existing entertainment corporations, which were based on the old 20th century centralised model. Having said that, I think you're completely right that also the internet corporations themselves are also trying to exert their own power and influence. Of course, that people-to-people thing, that sort of taking of data, the introduction of advertising, you know, wasn't there in the earlier stages. The earlier stages, it was much more about liberation, but now they recognise their power and they're beginning to use it. I suppose the two questions that arise from that, is that inevitable? I don't think it is. I think the two challenges that will be made to it are, one, technological. As I said, I think there are potentially technological changes which will undermine their own power. But then there's also political and social. And already we can see people fighting back against that. And people, for example, establishing new social networks which have a commitment not to take people's data, not to force advertising down people's throats, as a reaction against Twitter, for example, and Facebook. So, yes, enormous liberation. They're becoming increasingly a constraint. I don't think that will last forever. I think that will go. Can we trust ourselves? I think we can trust ourselves just as much as we can trust anyone in power, to tell the truth. I think there's this assumption that well-informed, well-educated, concentrated, powerful elites somehow make better decisions than the wider mass of people. I don't think there's any historical evidence to show that. In fact, I remember some years ago there was a study of referenda, which are held in states, you know, many states around America hold referenda on many important policy issues. And they compared decisions taken by state legislatures with decisions taken by direct democratic referenda. And they found there was no difference in terms of the extremism or moderation of the decisions taken. So, yes, I think we can inherently trust people to make the best decisions for themselves and for others. And then on the issue of the rule of law, etc., I mean, I believe very strongly in that you do need a state that has clear rules and regulations about how people interact with each other. I do believe very strongly in the rule of law. I think it's been one of the greatest advances of the last 500 years or so that we now, many countries now, accept the rule of law. So I'm not an anarchist or a libertarian. I'm not arguing against that. Will that always work in the interests of the powerful? Maybe to an extent. I mean, there's always a sense in which any structure is to a certain extent created in the image of those who are in power, and it does work in the interests of those in power. But I think with the sorts of trends we're seeing, we at least have a reasonably long period of time where that may be less the case.
I mean, tying those questions together very, very quickly, I just wonder to what extent you need a big power to take on big power. Thinking about, you know, big corporate interest, for example. I mean, it might not be that, notwithstanding technological change or value change, whatever, that small isn't quite up to the job sometimes. And if, for example, big technology companies are using our data in ways which we don't think is right, you need a big state counterweight to that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying that the state, as I said, I'm not a libertarian anarchist who says the state has no role. I think the state still has a very important, potentially regulatory role to make sure that people are acting fairly and that we're creating a level playing field for people and that there isn't too much inequality arising. But at the same time, I think the 20th century view that somehow the repository of wisdom and the best regulation, the best response to social problems always arises with the state or with big business, that's something that's now being very firmly challenged. And I think, you know, to take the example I've just given, the fact that we've already seen social networks springing up, which are there trying to challenge Twitter and Facebook, and that people are joining those social networks, suggests that there's more self-regulation going on in the system now than maybe we might have once expected back in the mid-20th century.
Okay, let's have another round of questions.
David Pooley, I'm a fellow here. One of the roles of the central bank is to control the money supply and to give some confidence to the user that there is regulation and order to the use of the currency. Using the Bitcoin example, who's controlling inflation of Bitcoin? Who's going to regulate the potential for people to be creating new quantities of Bitcoins without people knowing, and therefore essentially devaluing the currency that people are now trusting?
Okay, great. Thank you.
You said about this being driven by people's desire for freedom. I wonder if it's more to do, or that, in fact, may be a symptom of the fact that of the old adage that power corrupts, and that people will put up this, with people being big, corporations being big, banks, politicians having power, until they feel there's a complete lack of respect for them. Another good example at the moment, perhaps, is FIFA.
Yes, great. We'll come on to that.
You want to challenge your suggestion that migration represented a threat to or a rejection of the state. I think most migration happens for economic reasons, and that most migration across the world happens within countries, and that's why you've got Lagos, São Paulo developing into big cities of late. And of the international migration that happens, most of it is to the nearest available country, hence Lebanon, Turkey, Jordan, with the problem they have with Syrian refugees. There are very, very few intercontinental refugees. About 4% of the world's refugees come to Europe, for example. And it was interesting you mentioned Luther, because the biggest wave of refugees this country has ever received was 300 years ago, and it was the Huguenots coming, surprise, surprise, from the next door country. So I'm not sure that any of these represent a threat to the state from migration?
You're making me sound like coming over all UKIP. I didn't mean that migration was a threat to the state. God forbid. No, what I meant is that I think those levels of migration make it increasingly difficult for states to protect their borders, to, you know, control the inflow and outflow of migrants in the way that, you know, they did maybe more effectively for a large part of the 20th century. So that's what I was sort of trying to get at there. Bitcoin, well, of course, the way that Bitcoin is structured is that it's actually anti-inflationary because there's a limit on how many Bitcoins can be produced. I think it's 20 million, but I get that wrong. And then the code basically says there are no more Bitcoins. So they can't actually keep generating Bitcoins. Now, that compares quite interestingly with central banks, who throughout history have kept churning out money and are one of the major causes of continuous inflation over the last number of decades. So now, that might not be the case with every cryptocurrency. There are other currencies have different approaches. Of course, if you took a sort of Hayek's view on this, was that if you let people choose their currency, they would inevitably choose the best. They would choose the most stable, least inflationary, and they could be free of central banks who tend to like producing money because it gets governments off the hook and helps governments stay big. Whether that's true, whether Hayek is right, I don't know, but Bitcoin is actually potentially anti-inflationary. The issue about power corrupting, I think that's a very interesting point, and I think 2008 has obviously played a big role in this. I think there's a shifting ethos and culture amongst a lot of people, particularly amongst the younger generation, who don't feel any sense of allegiance or trust to some of those big centralised state-run and other organisations that maybe older generations did. I didn't mention here, but I've done a lot of work, and the RSA has done a lot of work on the rise of small business. The UK is really at the cutting edge of this. There's been an absolute explosion of so-called micro-businesses over the last 10, 20 years. We now have 5 million micro-businesses in the UK. And many of the younger people coming out of university that we engage with, you know, their deepest wish is to set up a startup. It's not to go and work in the city anymore, like maybe it was before 2008. They want to have control of their own destiny, their own organisation. They want to have impact and bring about change on their own terms. So I think there is a real zeitgeist change going on, which is fueling this as well.
But this question, I mean, going back to the point about FIFA, I think it's quite an interesting case point, albeit in a cultural rather than political domain. It is sort of an exemplar of an unaccountable supranational institution, of which there are a number. And you know, the question remains, how can we sort of tether and ensure that there is some accountability to basic values when those sorts of powers are out of reach? They're behind a wall, in effect.
But look at the credibility of those organisations. That's the point. I think 60, 70 years ago, as has been widely observed, there was a very different culture and ethos. People felt a natural sense of trust and deference towards particularly established bureaucrats and technocrats and professionals. They were seen to have a certain hold and knowledge and expertise, which meant people could trust them. FIFA is the perfect example of an organisation that has lost global credibility. It still hangs on, by its fingernails to its position of power, much like political parties in the UK. But how long is that model sustainable? How long can it really carry on like that without broad-based popular support? 10 years, 20 years, I wouldn't give it even that long. Either these organisations change radically or they disappear.
Hopefully not very long, I think, is the answer, right? Another quick round of questions.
I'm not completely sure what my questions. My name is Alison Parry, and a fellow. But I've been very... A lot of what you said has brought to mind chicken and egg, of which came first. I mean, you said something about money was invented for paying taxes. Actually, I thought money, and especially intermonetary union, was really for paying armies, and the Greeks did it in order to pay their armies. I think tax came later. And that also, I mean, for example, you said, how do we maintain equality, talking about equality between small and big. Well, you haven't even managed to do equality between men and women. So, why are you starting on something else?
Sorry, can I draw you to a question?
Where I'm going was, I mean, so many things are things that I feel that a lot of it is chicken and egg, and maybe you're looking at some of it from the wrong way. And the other one was, of course, the referenda. Without big business, or without the state, you wouldn't have the question or the places for the people to go and vote. Right. So it's how one's looking at it.
Okay. Hi, yeah. I kind of get the feeling that there is, along with all of this idea of, you know, redistribution of power and it becoming more decentralised, as you put it, that there's very much a risk of lulling people into a false sense of security. And I think the internet is one of the big culprits in this. You know, you talk about the fact that the internet has enabled us to see corruption and, you know, be exposed to the things that are going on in the world that are really appalling. But often what happens is that we're exposed to these things and we all sort of go, oh, well, you know, everyone can see it happening now, so, you know, it's all going to be sorted. And actually what happens is that everyone assumes, oh, that's fine, we all know about this now, it's going to change, and it doesn't. And I think there's something slightly dangerous about depicting it as this, you know.
So you think a sort of hashtag bring back our girls or whatever it was,
There is. It happens.
You get a flash of interest, and then yeah.
Exactly, and I think it's quite dangerous.
Okay, thank you very much. And this lady.
I'm wondering how one does as, and whether there is a between, particularly the big state and small organisations who would like to challenge that, almost a cavern that can't be broached. And I say that from the point of view of a very small organization working in the health sector, trying to work with the NHS, and there is just a complete David and Goliath situation in which I don't think David is going to win.
Brilliant. I think that's a really good question. What role for the sort of civil society, smaller organisations in between the two extremes?
Just on the issue of equality, I wasn't trying to talk about equality between small and big. What I was trying to say is, in a world where that's more shaped by smaller, decentralised organisations, how do we ensure that we can maintain decent levels of equality? And that goes for, you know, gender issues as much as economic and other issues as well. And I think that's a big issue we need to confront. I think the second question is absolutely brilliant, and I don't quite know the immediate answer to that. I mean, I suppose, you know, this is a trend. This is a set of conditions. This is a world we have to work in. And yeah, you may be right that one of the big risks of that is a sort of grasshopper type mentality. Oh, that was very interesting, and that sounded terrible. Let's move on to the next thing. Whereas the risk with the big centralized organization was that if the big centralized organization didn't care about something, it didn't get done. So there are risks with both. But I guess, you know, that's about human beings trying to address those issues and find ways to ensure that we can build sustained campaigns to bring about meaningful change, rather than just sort of thinking, you know, what's the next big horror that we want to move on
to. Is it a learning process? I mean, if you go on social media, it is just one succession of sort of emotional spasms after another. And are we going through a process of learning how to deal with this sort of flood of information in a way that can make sense to us, or is this now our world effectively?
This is why I think trying to develop a political system which is actually based upon deliberative processes, people having a direct, much more direct control over what Parliament does, being able to hold Parliament to account much more, will actually hopefully build in a structure where we can take forward as, you know, as communities, as people, as individuals, issues that we think are important. And we've got to keep in mind that the political party world is no less short-term than, you know, some of the areas we've been talking about. I mean, how many relaunches has Labour had in the last year? You know, some new issue that's supposed to revive people's interest in the Labour Party. But it sort of lasts about a month before they move on to the next thing. So we need to find the deliberative and direct mechanisms that can allow a longer-term interest.
Go to your point about responsibility in an interesting way. And finally, this point about civil society.
Well, yeah, I mean, for a long time now, people have been talking about, you know, using this jargonised phrase, what are the meso structures, the organisations between the big and the small, that are going to replace the structures we used to have in the 20th century, like the trade unions or the Women's Institute or the Rotary Club or the church. And I'm not entirely sure we're going to find them. I think what we have is something very different, which is collaborative mechanisms emerging online where lots of individuals and small organisations find ways of working together to work on things that are of mutual interest to them. And something like the sort of decentralised autonomous organisations is the sort of next stage of that, potentially. I think the issue of the NHS and its relationship to smaller organisations, I mean, that just goes back to the heart of 20th century structures hanging on by their fingernails. I mean, the NHS is a classic example of one of those big, centralised, hierarchical, bureaucratic organisations that were set up in the 1940s, and which really is no longer fit for purpose, is just suffering so much stress. And we need to find a way to adapt the NHS and many other public service institutions to this new world of small.
Great. We're going to have to wrap it up there, but that was so interesting. I thank you very much for a really great set of questions. The book is going to come out. It is being crowdfunded for. You've got to write it. It's called Small is Powerful, Why the Era of Big Business, Big Government and Big Culture is Over, and Why it's a Good Thing. So hopefully you'll have a look into that. There's details on the RSA website, and the publisher is Unbound. But finally, thank you, and thank you very much to Adam for an interesting conversation.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, thersa.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.